Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1054. So, yes, the Wizard Guitar Tour is just temporarily on hold while everything is sort of sorting out. So we have kind of frozen the tour page just until we get a better idea of how everything is going to shake out. But we will update you as soon as we obviously get more information. But if you go to id10t.com/signup, you can join the email list, and we'll keep you updated. And then we'll send you some positive messages every so often, too. And then, you know, just kind of like weird stuff we're making and that kind of thing. It's not too invasive in your inbox. And of course, you can unsubscribe at any time. So id10t.com/signup would be great. But let's talk about you, the ID10T community, like Roman, who writes, "Love your podcast. Been a long-time listener from back in the day." Oh my God, we've been on so long, there is a back in the day. "I'm writing to let you know I've got wood. Yes, I'm a nerd who has wood, but we made a thing while locked up in Corona Madness, and we figured we love them so much, we try to sell them to the masses to make some Corona scratch, and who knows beyond, so please check out our wood at geekswithwood.net. We're making art for geeks by geeks and pretty excited about sharing it with the world." I'm looking at it right now. It is really cool, like woodcraft that are very relevant to your pop culture interests. The homepage right there has some great Star Wars woodcrafting on it. So geekswithwood.net. Thank you, Roman. Now, this episode is Bill Pullman, who's awesome. Now, this is the first time that I'd mentioned that I hadn't done an internet-based podcast since, oh my gosh, it's been like 7 or 8 years. And we tried Skype, and the quality is okay because we did it via video chat. Because I thought, oh, video will be good because we can see each other, and then it'll be, you know, it'll just make the conversation that much simpler. But what it actually did was compromise the audio quality. So, you know, while we're exploring other options for that and Zoom or whatever, going forward, we're going to just do audio. I recorded a podcast today with just Skype audio, and I think it actually sounded really good. So this one today with Bill will sound a little bit like a phone call. I'm not going to lie, it was fun to video chat with Bill Pullman, which is a fun sentence I never thought I would get to say in my life. But he was great and just really sweet and affable and really embraced a lot of the stuff that we talked about, just like iconic things that he's done in his career. And, you know, maybe pulled out the dark helmet from Spaceballs. He loved it. So anyway, it was really fun. Also, I think he may have had his email program open because I did hear like the Apple email alert ding occasionally. I'm only telling you that because if you hear it, you might go, "Oh my God, am I getting an email?" It's probably coming. It's inside the podcast. The alerts are coming from inside the podcast. So I just wanted to let you know. By the way, Bill Pullman is promoting season 3 of The Sinner, which is on USA. The season finale airs the day that this is posting, which is Thursday, March 26th. All episodes are available at usanetwork.com. So, as always, I hope you are staying safe. I hope you are staying healthy. I hope you are staying home. I appreciate you for listening, and I hope that our little digital offerings can offer you, as I said last week, an escape from all the stuff. So here you go, the ID10T podcast number 1054 with Bill Pullman.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
I literally just, I do usually a live television show on Sunday nights, and we just have been doing a Skype version of it. How are y'all doing?
Good. Yeah, I'm just figuring this out. The Skype, I used to Skype a lot more. And then all of a sudden the FaceTime and in Europe and things like that, you know, shifted, and it was easy to text and FaceTime. So I dropped out of Skype, but now it's good to be back.
I know, because it's really hard to, I mean, I've had a bunch of meetings via Skype or Zoom, and it does feel like some bizarre dystopian future movie where it's like, oh, people, this is how people communicate now. We all look at each other on a screen, and someday maybe we'll get to see each other in person, but that doesn't seem like it's going to be soon. So this is the new normal.
My daughter leads a choir, and they're now downstairs getting on Zoom so that 23 people can all be there, and they're trying to figure out, can they hear each other? And I don't think they'll ever work it out that they'll be able to sing together on Zoom.
Right.
But she mutes them and hopes for the best.
This must be very surreal to be promoting Sinner. Like, I would imagine a lot of the publicists all of a sudden went, oh, shit, how are we going to promote all these things that people worked so hard on? So are you doing a series of Skype chats to promote? Is that what your day-to-day is now?
Well, you know, a lot of the old-style just audio phone conversations. And then I did the radio junket, you know, which was all, that's just waking up early in the morning and talking to a lot of different cities. And that's always been that way. But, but this is the first time on Skype, so you're pushing the envelope.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate that you wanted to do video, because I don't think in 10 years of doing these podcasts, I always insisted, like, well, we have to be in person, because there's so much to communication that's about body language, and I need to know, like, if people are comfortable talking about different things, and when they're shifting in their seat or whatever, and so being able to read all that is so important. And I started hearing, like, oh, people want to do audio only. I'm like, oh my God, it's going to be like the 80s when we just used to call people on the phone and be like, what's up? You know?
This is good. But I do get a context for you. I get the guitar over there, is to see. It looks a lot like our library. A little less gothic, though. I think there's some. Is that a jawbone?
So that's there's a taxidermy. There's a vintage taxidermy alligator head there. Behind him is a giant, like, bird-eating spider. It's just one of those giant sort of tarantula-type spiders that eat birds. Then there's a guitar. And then I just have a bunch of weird oil paintings in my office. And my wife and I like a lot of weird goth. It's like, if you came to our house, you would sort of feel like, like a weird Victorian museum in a strange kind of way. So yeah, we're into all that weird stuff. What's your dominant aesthetic?
Haphazard. I think our dominant aesthetic was connected to the fact that this used to be close by or somewhere close to a pineapple grove in 1910.
Oh wow.
House was built in 1917, so that whole idea of agriculture in California in 1910 is probably the biggest arts and crafts, painted arts and crafts house. And then I have the orchard outside, so It's got a little bit of agricultural, California agriculture.
About nice. And so you feel, is it a comfortable place to be holed up indefinitely?
Yes. Yeah. It's really, it's a very, atmosphere. Everybody says this is the best house for holidays because it's got a very traditional side to it.
Good. Well, I was so blown away that you agreed to do the podcast just because, listen, you've literally been in some of the greatest films in the history of film, and your career spans so many different, like, there's not one type of Bill Pullman movie. It's just like, I imagine, was your theater background, I've never seen someone's career so much sort of mirror what it must be like, a film version of a theater background, where it's like, you play any kind of character in any kind of production, and that's just it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I live in denial of it, but then there's certain kind of perfect storms where a bunch of product that's been kind of in the works kind of getting clogged up, and then they all kind of go. And was it? It was in February. In February, where I had done this wild movie in Poland two years ago called The Coldest Game.
Okay.
And a chess player in 1962 who's in a chess match in Warsaw, and he's on the spectrum. So it's a little Bobby Fischer-esque and wild, crazy, epileptic fits, everything. And at the same time that I was in the play that I had done last year, All My Sons, was recorded by National Theatre Live, and we performed it in front of 600,000 people live.
Oh my gosh.
Except for the US, where it was held because there was a production in New York. So that got released in cinemas, you know, in their kind of like little cultivated art house release where you can see an art house movie. And that was in February. Then a couple things came out on Netflix. I got access to The Ballad of Lefty Brown, which is me as, you know, kind of the sidekick, limping sidekick, and that was the same time as The Sinner started to air. So it was like a shitstorm of Pullman, man.
If you ever write a book, just consider Shitstorm of Pullman. Just consider it.
Right.
Because I feel like if I saw that on a shelf, I'd be like, I don't know what, I need to read that, whatever it is, I need to read that. But
right.
even going back to, was Ruthless People your first movie?
Yeah.
I mean, what an amazing first movie. It's legitimately one of the best comedy, like, the best comedies that came out of that decade, Ruthless People. And were you doing a lot of theater at that point? Is that where you were kind of making your bread and butter and then just sort of transitioned over?
Yeah, I just was gold digging. You know, I came out to LA to do a play, and it was about Russians in Afghanistan in 85.
Oh, wow.
Americans were in Afghanistan. It was really, but I had dyed my hair blonde to be a Russian tank commander. And it was a wild experience, and I had never dyed my hair before. And while I was out here, I started to audition, and the Zucker brothers and Jim Abrams, who were the directors, I was in for a very small part. I was lucky to be there. They were laughing kind of spontaneously. It was like Immaculate Conception laughs, you know, not born of something I could put my finger on, nothing I was saying or anything. It wasn't responding, and it turns out later they said they loved my hair. For this part, and I ended up getting the part of Daryl, I guess, and then I had to recover my hair 2 months later when we went to shoot it. But it was a wild time to transition from theater into doing the movies, and I was thinking, okay, I'll just get this money, which I really needed it at the time, and I'll head back to New York. But then, you know, things happened, and it didn't happen. And Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft came to see me in a play at LATC, another play that I was in, So it really is a big start of my career was connected to theater.
Oh, that's really interesting because I was just talking to Carrie Elwes on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he said Mel came to see Princess, I think it was Princess Bride maybe, and then put him in Robin Hood Men in Tights. It was like Mel seems like the kind of guy that he would just go out because he loved comedy. He loved – and he would go, oh, I want to work with that person. And then he would find something for you.
Well, yeah. I think he saw something in Ruthless People he liked. But the play I was doing was a medieval pageant play about Barabbas.
Wow.
Instead of Christ. No comedy that we were attending. But they came and they, you know, got – And he used to make a joke that because he tried to get Tom Hanks and Tom Cruise, but he couldn't get a Tom, so he got a Bill. He used to, and Bill was like, oh, out of the blue, man. I had just done that one little part in Ruthless People, and there I was walking down into the little Fox commissary behind Mel Brooks and meeting, you know, Jane Fonda and Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it was... there was a Bill following along, not a Tom.
But was it? Had you done a lot of comedy in theater, or was it? Was it? I mean, because obviously your first two movies were really hardcore comedies and two totally different types of comedies at the same time. So was that? Was comedy kind of in your on your radar at that point, or it's like, oh, well, I'm getting cast in this. I guess I'll just do it.
Yeah, I think I just had done comedies in theater and, you know, I toured with a theater company and outdoors and we did a lot of Molière and a lot of Commedia plays. And so there was them and the Shakespeare comedies. So maybe that was the most concentrated. I did learn from some pretty good theater. One guy in particular was very influential, you know. In these theater companies, you end up with one heavyset guy who plays all the rustics in Shakespeare. And this guy, Moran, was like, I learned so much about what was funny, especially what was funny outdoors, what you had to do to get focused and get a laugh on some of that Shakespearean stuff.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is that comedy in theater is very different from comedy on film. You know, where there's like there are no reactions, and you also, I would imagine, you have to play everything a lot smaller because there's a camera in your face. But did it take a minute to sort of get Mel's wavelength in that movie? Because it's Mel just kind of has his own genre, basically. He is sort of a subgenre of comedy. So going into that, did you know that? I assume you had probably seen, you know, Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, and History of the World and all that. Or was there like a learning curve where it's like, oh, okay, I guess this is sort of the vibe of this?
Well, I think with Mel, you know, so much of it is really deep-rooted in Catskill, vaudeville,
yeah.
You know. And those, and Ronnie Burke and Thomas... the writer, they all were shared a lot of those kind of style. And so I really learned because I had already kind of had a version of what I thought film acting was, which was, you know, not repeat myself and look to get, if it was a funny line, to see if I could milk it in a lot of different ways, you know. No, that wasn't what he wanted. He know what I was going to do. You know, we'd go in there for rehearsals. Only Daphne and I would submit to rehearsals, and somehow John Candy and Rick Moranis refused to do it. Basically, it was so priceless. I'm so glad Mel made me do it. I learned so much right away. And basically, he would do the line, you know, and he would do Daphne's line. And I, you know, just saw what genius it was for him to, and he just wanted me to hit the mark every time we do a rehearsal. He couldn't see the same thing enough, you know, like, yeah, no, that same delivery that you did yesterday that I said I liked, that one. And I just, oh, really? Okay, I'll just keep hitting this, you know. And I don't know whether it was just the him, but he, what did he? He was very very helpful that way, you know. And then by the time we went to shoot it, you know, I don't know if it was the most favorite way that I've worked in comedies. For me, it's not, you know, probably as it was great to do it in that context, but I didn't feel like that was something that I needed to do for the rest of my life. So much of, you know, of it now, comedy is deadpan, reactions, those kind of things, you know, which are really born from being in the circumstances in the moment as intensely as you can be, you know?
Yeah. I didn't realize, I might go grab it in a sec. It's downstairs, but I actually bought at a movie auction. My wife and I have like a lot of weird movie props and stuff. I have Rick Moranis's helmet, the actual helmet from the movie. And I got him to sign it and I got Mel to sign it. And so if we had been in person, there would have been a Bill Pullman signature on there as well.
God, how did you get it?
It just, you know, the sort of the movie prop auction scene right now is big because literally everyone can bid on stuff in the world. So it's just these sort of like online entertainment auctions, and it came up and I bought it and I have it, and it's amazing. It is absolutely amazing. It's flimsy, but it's, you know, it's the fucking helmet. And it's before we wrap this up at some point, I'll run down and get it just so you can see it. But it really was like, I was so excited to get that thing. I mean, that movie, that's just, it's a piece of comedy history. So yeah. When you're working on stuff and you sort of move on, and then years later, some nerd like me is like, hey, remember the part in Spaceballs? Are you like, what? I haven't thought about that movie in like 30 years. Like, do you just sort of like do the job and then just kind of move on?
Well, yeah. You know, when we did that, it was so long ago. It was before VHS.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was probably about 7 or 8 years later that I at the house, and we're having my wife's cousins over. The cousin had just come into L.A., had him over, and somehow in the conversation I mentioned something, had some reference to Spaceballs, and he goes, wait a minute, can we talk about Spaceballs? I said, yeah. And he knew all my dialogue. And I listened to him, and I go, I don't really know if that's what I said, but he remembered it, and I bet you that's exactly what I said. So then I had to go back and watch it.
Yeah. That's so you watched it? Did you watch it again?
I watched it then when it came out on VHS, so that was probably in the 90s, mid-90s.
I love, by the way, that someone, like, he was probably just waiting for you to give him the green light. Like, yes, we can talk about, oh my God, I didn't know that was on the table. Here, you know, I mean, that type of, I don't know. I mean, that type of fandom, it's so common to be able to communicate with people that you see because of social media. But certainly in the 80s and 90s, you didn't really, like, people just didn't have access to people that they saw and stuff, being able to communicate or talk to them or send out messages all the time. So I'm sure he was like one of the highlights for that guy. And it was nice that you appreciated that.
Yeah, it was definitely, he got some goosebumps.
Well, I also remember that you did another movie after Spaceballs, which was totally different, like you said, which I loved, which was Serpent and the Rainbow, which was such a great, creepy, the trailer for that movie when I was in high school just freaked the shit out of me. It's just being buried alive and don't let them bury me. I'm not dead yet. I mean, that movie was such a great, it was so visceral. Were you offered other comedies after Ruthless People and Spaceballs? Did you actively turn away in search of like a darker kind of a thematic, almost psychological horror piece?
You know, I think it just came up in the course of events. So I later did other comedies. I did, I think shortly after there, I had done Sibling sibling rivalry with Carl Reiner.
Yep.
But the Serpent and Rainbow came up as more like, wouldn't this be an amazing adventure to take this real life story of this ethnobotanist, Wade Davis, and meet him, and he's a consultant on the movie, and he was the one who had gone down there, embedded himself in the Tantamaku, and learned this exact recipe that they were using to make this, you know, poison, essentially, that could render human with no body functions, but still be alive. You know, then they, and that was a big adventure. We went down to Haiti and shot it in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. That was my third movie, and I thought they were all going to be that way. And I don't think I ever got a repeat of some of them.
I mean, for you, how does the job part of it not get in the way of the sort of artistic part of it? You know what I mean? It's like, there's a lot of job stuff, you know, you got to do press. You have to like you said, it's not always going to Haiti. You know, there is sort of a clock in element to it. And so for you, what is the balance between still being able to infuse the artistic part when it feels like the work side of the business is like 80% of it? And the art side, you really only get to do for like 10 or 20% of the time.
Right, that's right. Yeah, I think the hardest thing is when you have to do press for something before you've shot it. You know, they're starting to do that more and more. And when we did the sequel to Independence Day, we had a junket for it in Albuquerque, and I don't think I had shot more than 1 or 2 days. And we're already talking about how we did the role and, you know, all of this stuff. And it was a little uncomfortable, but
I know, especially because at that point it almost doesn't matter what you say. You know what I mean? Because it's like, you know, there's so much media and there's so much press. If you say something that doesn't happen in the movie, is anyone, you know, by the time it comes out, is anyone going to remember or notice? It's just like, are you on social media at all? At all?
No, not at all. No.
Your life is probably significantly more peaceful as a result, but there's so much, you know, we're just inundated so much with everything all the time that I'm sure it was fine. But Independence Day was, I remember that being like the sort of return of the real summer blockbuster when that movie came out. And I didn't know much about it before it came out. And then all of a sudden it was just this massive, massive international hit. Was there any sense of that when you guys were making the first Independence Day? Like, we're making a blockbuster, guys. Or was it just like, yeah, you know, it's kind of a weird alien movie. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. It really was not expected to be that big a movie, I think, for most people. I think in January of that year that it came out, there was a list of 20 movies to look forward to in the summer, and it wasn't on the list.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, and then it started to kind of creep in, and it started to pick up a little bit. But it was once they got that image of the White House blowing up, there was something about that, and the whole logo of July 2, they came, July 3, they attacked, July 4th, the day we fought back.
Right.
And that was a real, like, duh, this movie. What the heck is this?
Well, it also had so many, there were also so many great elements, like the actual concerned president and the snarky military, you know, like, Will Smith, who's still, like, you know, dropping one-liners in the middle of an attack. And they're like, you know, you got Jeff Goldblum in Jeff Goldblum form. And also, let's just talk about uploading a virus from a MacBook in the 90s to an alien spacecraft, which not, you know, this was, there wasn't Wi-Fi or anything at the time. That now, of course, we understand how networks work. But at the time, that was a very revolutionary idea to use it was a PowerBook, actually, not even a MacBook. I think it was a PowerBook, like the original Mac laptop, to upload onto that thing. So I just think it did have a lot of elements that were very fresh that we hadn't really seen in a movie yet, in addition to the special effects.
That's a good point. Yes. Yeah, that had the...
Was it fun to revisit all of that? Like, when you heard there was going to be a second one, were you like, what? We did it the first time! Or was it like, oh my god, this will be fun. It's been, you know, 20-some years.
Yeah, it was really great. I loved all those guys. You know, the Roland Emmerich is such a really wonderful movie maker. I just been being kind of refreshed with this way of there's always some moments where he would say, this time you come through and it would be really cool if you did this. And we're going to have this effect over here. It's really cool, you know, and he just has such a thrill of making things kind of in his, according to his lexicon, cool.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Yeah, but there's also, you know, you must have a sense. You must have some sort of a spider sense when it comes to picking movies, because you do such great examples of each type of genre. Like, you know, Wyatt Earp is a really great movie. Independence Day is great. Lost Highway is a whole other thing, you know. Lake Placid is a movie, another movie where I think people are like, oh, it's like a big alligator movie, whatever. And then all of a sudden it's huge and the movie's amazing, you know. It's like, you must, what is your selection process? Are you using runes, or are you, do you have some type of psychic ability? What is it that is, what speaks to you about a project when you read it that makes it feel special to you?
You know, I don't know. Some of them don't do as well as I think they are. You know, and I was just thinking about that because I went to get a cup of tea in this mug, which is a Welsh flag symbol, and it was given to me by Russell T. Davies, who is the guy who wrote Torchwood.
Torchwood and Doctor Who.
Yeah, he did the revamp of Doctor Who, and then the spinoff Torchwood, and then we did Miracle Day, which was a 10-part series about, you know, this phenomena that happened when I play a murdering pedophile.
Right.
And they're trying to kill me with a lethal injection at the top of the movie, and it doesn't work. And then they realize that someone else that was expected to die didn't die right after that. And they realize from me on, no one is dying. And they thought it was a miracle, but quickly, it became clear that no one's getting better, so they're all hovering in sickness. So the whole amount of where are we going to get the resources to take care of these people? And I've been waiting for somebody to draw an analogy between that Torchwood and this, and it's just below the radar enough, I guess, that it hasn't struck, but I keep thinking that was one of the great premises and really, you know, a great allegory too for planet Earth.
Well, yeah. And Russell, I mean, I'm a huge Doctor Who fan. And of course, and you know, Torchwood and John Barrowman and, you know, I mean, it's such a great universe. And Russell was so good at sort of tackling a lot of, you know, a lot of these kind of like philosophical life questions about us, but through the lens of, you know, like aliens and the universe and sci-fi. And it, to me, those Doctor Who, like Doctor Who and Torchwood, I sort of put them in the same category as like, you know, the original Rod Serling Twilight Zone, where it's like there's such great commentary and very progressive commentary on our culture, but, you know, like done in a way that is, you know, through this other kind of sci-fi lens. So I completely understand. But when that happens for you, like when you go, oh, I think this is going to be amazing, and it doesn't, you know, and it's not as big as you had hoped it would be, do you have sort of a mantra like a, well, on to the next thing, or do you have to mourn that for a second, or are you just sort of like, you know, it's just part of the business?
Yeah, I guess I live in such delusion. I avoid social media, so I don't see a lot of references to how disastrous something is. And I live with the thought that it was so much fun to make it, and that those that I have talked to that liked it a lot, and I'm going to live with that, you know. So I've kind of gotten a little bit hardened to the fact that some things get rejected.
Well, but I also think that it's, you know, it's such an interesting idea, and especially one that I think a lot of people are really coming to understand, especially now, but the idea that, you know, we don't really control anything, and we sort of build these bubbles of security where we kind of, you know, we're able to trick ourselves into thinking we have some sense of control, either through routine or whatever it is that we do, or we have stability and security, and something like this happens, and we realize, oh, we really, you know, we don't, you know, we can sort of control how we react to things. But being an actor, you have about the least control in the entertainment business, right? Because you get hired, but you still have no control over, you know, oh, they didn't hire you because you're not 6'2", you're only 6'1", or they needed someone with this color hair. And then when you get the job, you don't know what take they're going to use. You don't know how they're going to light it. You don't know how it's going to be edited. I mean, you really have to be comfortable with not having any control and just showing up and doing what you do, I guess, and hoping for the best. Is that sort of how it works?
Yeah. And some of it is like psychological. Am I crazy here? You know? Like, if you don't get validated for your thinking process or what you understand humans should be interested in, and what wins their intelligence and wins their all of that, then it becomes a little bit of a scary sense of being way outside the curve of what most people think. And I, you know, it's interesting. I do large parts, small parts, and dark Waters was, I have a small part in that, but a good part, and with Mark Ruffalo. And that movie, I think I was so, even though I didn't have the hugest investment in it, time-wise, the story was so good, and Todd Haynes is such a great filmmaker, and the movie is so profound and challenging and about relationships and a lot of things beyond just the social justice issue of it. And the fact that I was realizing with the Academy, I wasn't seeing any traction, nobody talking about it, nobody including it on their top 10 lists. And I felt a little bit insane that it wasn't getting traction. You know.
Yeah, but I would imagine, you know, at a certain point, you probably just have to go, you know what, though? But I showed up. I got to be a part of this thing. I did what I did. And that's sort of the process of that is the reward. I mean, how much, you know, like it obviously feels great to be validated externally, but I think the people, you know, that have like a strong, you seem to me like you have a good center, like you seem like a grounded guy. And I'm wondering, where does that come from? Did you learn to be that? Or is it someone in your life, or were you raised that way? Or is it innate? Like, what has allowed you to continue to sort of just, you know, move ahead, focus, keep working all these years, and keep your head on your shoulders?
You know, I think I've been thinking a lot about my family because they're, most of them are in medicine in one type or another. Mm-hmm. And this, during this period where you're seeing caregivers really push to the limit and My brother's an infectious disease doctor in Montana. But my parents, I think, and when my mother was a nurse, my father was a doctor. And I think their acceptance of every type of humanity that walked into their office, there was something about that ethic that never spoke disparagingly about any of their patients. And he was in a small town, and every one of them was interesting to him, and everyone deserved his fullest attention. And I think there was a great embrace of humanism that he had, and my mother as well, you know, that said whether things are going poorly or not, there's always somebody that's suffering a little bit more than you are, and you should be aware of them. And if someone's getting excluded, you can always draw the circle a little larger to keep them inside, you know. And so maybe that's in these times, I think a lot about that kind of teachings that you get when you're growing up that's invaluable.
That's really interesting to hear, because it as you're saying that, it makes me realize that one of the things that I think you're so amazing at is just playing human, like real human people, just like a guy, you know, like a guy going through some shit, and you are able to ground that in a way. By the way, I think just playing like a regular person is so much harder than a crazy character who has a lot of tics or a lot of, you know, like something to really hook onto, because that to me sort of feels like, oh yeah, you know, like that's, you have that dimension to jump into when you don't know what else to do. But just to play a person, to play a guy going through stuff, that to me seems really hard, because who is that guy? What do they latch onto? And it sounds like, because of the way that you were brought up, it's just finding their humanity. It's like, how do you unpack them and just find that sort of like, how do you empathetically connect with their humanity? Is there a process that you go through to sort of do that when you're cracking into stuff, or is it just second nature?
Well, it must be maybe, I don't know. I think it just, yeah, because part of it is that I feel like one of the great joys of working on the sinner is this kind of quality that he has, which is in the script, and it kind of comes about, and maybe that's why Derek found me, was something that Derek believes in about radical empathy.
Mm-hmm.
I never had heard that term before, and he may have coined it, but that sense of radical being being empathetic to put yourself really in somebody's shoes in a way to really not just feel sorry for somebody, but to really try to understand and accept the way they're ticking, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's somewhat of a, you know, thing for Ambrose that becomes a little bit, makes him vulnerable. As he starts with something, approaching somebody like Matt Bomer's character,
right,
where he's really, really sensing there is a genuine conflict within this person, and this person wants help sometimes, and then at other times doesn't, and is dangerous. And how do you keep your the ballast in the ship going? How do you keep afloat, tipping over when you're next to that, when you're inside those kind of, that kind of radical empathy?
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Here. Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Do you ever, are you ever able to just sort of shake it off? Like, because obviously when you become empathetic, you do feel things, you know, you feel things for these characters, even though it's pretend. You feel things for them. And so, do you have any kind of a ritual that sort of shakes off the last role and moves on to the next role, you know, or are you able to just sort of clock in and clock out that way?
I don't know. I think, I was shooting this Netflix series about Halston, and I played David Mahoney, who was the corporate head of Norton Simon Industries, okay. The one who bought the licensing, had the vision that he could bring someone like Halston, this wild renegade designer, into a very corporate structure and make him flourish. And so there was a guy who, his book is called something like The Confessions of a Street Savvy Corporate Head or something. And, you know, that kind of certainty, self-assurance, everything was great to kind of shuck off Ambrose and get into a whole different breathing pattern and, you know, shave my beard, change everything. And so I was really getting into that a lot, and then we got shut down. So I'll have that to go back to.
I'm glad that, I'm glad that you'll be able to go back to that, because I would imagine you probably, like you said, everything you want to be different. And so do you ever sort of say to your representatives, like, just bring me something weird. I just want to do something that's so far out there, some sort of really crazy character piece. Are there different sides to your creative mind that you feel like you still want to scratch, or that you just sort of, you know, get caught up in sometimes that you want to do?
Well, I think I remember there was a period where I felt like I was not getting enough, as I call them, salty dogs.
You mean it's like the military general, or the, like, you guys need to watch your ass and get me in? Is it like that guy?
Yeah, curmudgeonly, having attitude, not being sympathetic, you know, being somewhat of a curmudgeon, you know. And I even put together a little file of pictures of myself that I said, these are salty dogs that Pullman has kind of warped through. And I just wanted to remind myself of the salty dog wing of the gallery of portraits of Pullman.
I love the idea that you're trying to convince people, like, look, I know you think I'm a nice guy, but I can be an asshole, okay? Can you please just make me? And they're like, no, I'm sorry, Billy, you're just a nice guy. You're a nice guy. What do you want? You're a nice guy.
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely. And there's been a lot of not nice guys recently. I mean, definitely Ambrose is not a nice guy.
Right.
You know, you're very isolated, very caught, you know, very, you know, not fluid at all. Disappointing for people, antisocial, all those behaviors. So I think I landed a few salty dogs.
Well, that's good. That's good. Yeah. I mean, you're in the movie Singles, if you remember it, for like 5 minutes. But you have there's even such a humanity with that character, where he just, like, there's that turn where you just go, see, I just don't know how to have fun. Like, and it's so endearing. And I'm curious how you're able to take, like, you know, 5 minutes of screen time and do something magical with it like that, there could have been someone else who just sort of, like, didn't, you know, like, whatever. He was a doctor. He was a breast augmentation doctor. He's in and out in 5 minutes, and it's fine, you know. But are you, like, is that conscious or are you working, you know, do you say to Cameron Crowe, like, well, I have an idea, here's how I kind of want to do this? Or do you kind of make the note before and then just run with it when you're on the day?
I just always hope that when I get there and start doing the thing that I want to be, the space I want to be in, that it's going to be something the director feels like is good and appropriate for the movie. And I did, you know, in Dark Waters, I had not that huge a part, but it was really, I knew this guy kind of how it would operate. And Todd Haynes, being the director, is just let it fly and gave great permission and great encouragement. And so I didn't get mucked with, you know, in terms of I got supported and got good notes and everything, but there was a basic conception of the character that was great. So the secret about Singles is that I got cut hugely.
What?
Yeah, because, and Cameron, you know, was a great director, you know, great person and everything, and so invested in all the characters. But if you remember, what's his name? Dr. Jameson.
Dr. Jameson.
Yeah. He doesn't come into the story until one, you know, it's an ensemble picture, and Bridges' character was really flowering later. And it's really kind of midway through the movie that she goes and decides she's going to have this boob job. And that's when Jameson said, you know, really, I don't think you need this. And I first read the part and turned it down. And Bridget Fonda had sent word through and said, Pullman, you got to accept this. Just talk to Cameron. You'll see. I talked to Cameron and he said, what's wrong? Why don't you take this part? And I said, well, my father was still alive at the time, and he was a blood and guts doctor. And he always, if there were a few times where I felt a little short of patience and disrespect, it was for plastic surgeons.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And I said to Cameron, I don't want my father to see me playing a plastic surgeon in his lifetime.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. And so how did they convince you to do it?
He said, I want to put that in the movie. And so we had this whole thing that I can't remember if this part is in there or not, but it's where he says, look, I'm doing this plastic surgery, but I don't even believe in it. I don't think I'm going to be doing it much more. And it was a short reference to something we did see later. But in that moment, we decide that we are not a likely pair to see each other, but why don't we try? And so we have an attempt at a relationship. And I have this kind of awakening that I'm really just recently divorced and not great in a position to really feel comfortable with someone a little younger than myself, and that I didn't understand the music and that.
That's so fun. I mean, that movie like helped launch that whole genre of music. That's really funny.
And here was Jameson going, I'm just sorry. And so he gets us all prepared to say to her, and he goes to her house, and she's had this kind of like also awareness that maybe he's going to reject her. And she gets this advice that when someone like that you had a relationship, having a relationship is about to reject you, you can reduce its impact on you if you picture them in embarrassing circumstances. I came to the door, I started to say, look, I think so much of you, but, and then all of a sudden I'm a clown. I'm in a whole clown.
such a bummer that that got cut. That's fantastic.
Really, and so he called me up, you know, just before I was going to get released and everything. He said, Bill, I got to apologize. I, you know, cut all that stuff out. But when I saw the movie, I thought, what a blessing in disguise, because there was something really beautiful about our relationship in that brief little minute that didn't need the comedy afterwards. In a way, it was more vivid by what potential it had that it didn't fulfill than it did by fulfilling something disappointing.
I love the idea that, like, a lot of times an actor will call their parents and go, listen, I did nudity in this movie. There's a weird sex scene. I'm picturing you calling your dad and going, Lick, I don't know how to tell you this. I play a plastic surgeon. I know. Like, what are you? did you break the news to him, or did you just not see the movie?
I don't think he saw the movie eventually, because he died in 92, and I think we did the movie in 91. I'm not sure if it had come out yet or not, but he was pretty much on a slippery slope by that time. But I did wear, I had a pair of his shoes, you know, that I carried with me. I still have them, and I did wear them as Jameson, you know, to kind of keep me honest during the whole thing.
That is such a beautiful story. You have no idea, like, that kind of depth and thought and empathy, and also even just hearing you say that, it's like, oh my gosh, that makes so much, the context of that, based on, like, how human the Jameson character is, it paints in all of this other background that I didn't know about before. I'm so glad you shared that story. That's a fantastic story.
Well, and it speaks to the genius of somebody like Cameron Crowe, who says, I'll include it.
Yeah.
I'll include your objection to doing this part. And then you think, wow, that's really somebody who's fluid and can, you know, really make something out of what's actually happening in front of you, rather than just some kind of conceit.
With all of the different roles, is there any one in particular that you sort of feel like more connected to than others, or does everything just sort of bleed together?
You know, different moments in my life. Some of the ones that I think, you know, I guess I think of some that I always wished could be revived, or that I had some kind of real joy that was really hard to leave the part. And sometimes they're not always the most successful movie. But Mr. Wrong was a character that I really – there was something so good about being such a lunatic. Oh God! When everyone thought that this is the most normal person, and she thought he's Mr. Right, and then he starts reading poetry, and Ellen DeGeneres is amazing in it. She's just a genius at reacting, and you know. But that movie, I don't know if it'll ever get full due. It was, you know, it has the stigma of kind of, she was still, you know, not kind of out yet, and so the premises of it were a little bit, I don't know. She jokes a lot about it on her TV show, but she hasn't asked me on her show yet. So.
I don't mean to laugh. It was just sort of like, I don't know if you thought about that before it just came out. Like, oh, she's been a good sense of humor. Although I don't recall having been asked to be on the show. Now that I think about it, maybe, I don't know. But I guess it's just sort of like, you know, looking at the tapestry of everything that you've been able to do, I really hope that you feel as much joy as you have brought so many different types of audiences because of the breadth of the types of stuff that you have worked on. I mean, do you seem like a pretty humble guy, so I don't know if it's anything that you think about, but do you ever, and this can all be in Shitstorm of Pullman, which obviously is the book you're going to write after this podcast, but what do you think about when you think about your career? How do you see it? What does it mean to you personally?
I guess it's like a child that other people say, are you proud of your child? And as if they kind of wonder whether you should be. And I I've had so many transformational experiences, you know, but it's spread in a kind of pattern that really is, you thank God it's not a virus because you'd never know where it came from. But because I think of like the fact that I did, I did a version of Othello in Norway live in theater about 4 years ago with this guy that I had worked with 28 years before, and I wanted to work with him, and I spoke Norwegian for 15% of it.
Oh,
and
my
English,
God.
And then listened to about 60% of what was said to me was in Norwegian, and it was, you know, these kind of experiences that I think, am I going to live through this? And the fact that I lived through them all and somehow made it through to the other side has been very, very rewarding. And I have just had a couple of years of really good run. So I'm feeling like I do every once in a while think, I don't know, having that repeat of Sinner, you know, it's the first time I've ever done a recurring part, and I lived in fear of it. I just thought, this is going to kill me if I get into something and I see everybody just showing up and plug, like you said, punched in the clock or something. That would kill me, and still be doing it and listening to people justify why they're doing it because of the money or something like that would really, but instead I get something I can't believe is so engrossing, and the part is so, and so much collaboration with the writer, and be able to make it so autobiographical. The whole second series is about Ambrose going back to his hometown in Western New York State, which is basically built on my whole autobiography and from being from there and things in my past. So I guess I'm pretty pretty glad that it's all. I don't know if anybody else would want it for a career, but I love it.
Well, and you also, like, I know you've written plays as well. I was reading about Expedition 6, and it's a fascinating idea for a play. And I don't think I ever would have. Like, how do you do that as a? How do you? Because it's basically about the. It's about people essentially trapped in space, basically.
Yeah, that was, and I, some of the cases, I trained as a theater director, you know, and I made a lot of plays with documentary material. So that was one that I made from a true story up at, when the Columbia blew up on February 3rd, 2002, there were three astronauts on the space station essentially stranded because they couldn't bring them down and to send up another shuttle. And just what it would be like to be in space looking down on Earth in that kind of bottleneck of history. We did it all with low flying trapeze.
My gosh. That's incredible. So you had to fold in wire work at the same time with everything else?
Yeah, this was well, it was the low-flying, you know, the single point, so it's on one axis, and it's not like the Chinese style trapeze. But, I worked with nine actors that were trained in this, and, yeah, so I get to do a lot of things, and I'm making a play about this artist, Charlie Russell. And I'm working with my son who makes puppets. I have a middle son who makes puppets.
That's fantastic.
So, you know, I keep going at what amuses me, whether anybody else gets it to see it or not.
Do you mind if I just run down to the next room and grab the Spaceballs helmet really fast?
May the Schwartz be with you.
It'll take me 30 seconds. I'll be right back.
It almost doesn't fit through the door.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wow. That is amazing. Right? And it just fits over your shoulders. Yeah.
Yeah, it fits. It fits pretty perfectly.
Wow. That's a problem.
Oh, I'm so glad that I got to. Yeah, in there.
Amazing. Yep. Yes. Oh.
I really can't thank you enough. This is. I hope this was okay for you. And it actually was totally. It felt totally normal to me. Like, you really helped make this sort of feel not weird in these weird times.
Well, I appreciate you're so interested in movies, and I just when you said that about Torchwood, Steve, I have to say that gave me warm heart because that you said that Doctor Who and Torchwood are like in the category of Twilight Zone, you know,
absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, I'm just such a huge Doctor Who fan, and you know, I'm sure you know that Torchwood is an anagram for Doctor Who. And I do think that the people who know Torchwood and who know that world, it's not a casual love affair they have with those things. I mean, like the fans of it are super fans. So just you should be you should feel good knowing that the people that did get to see it fucking love it. So it's that should be of some that should get some mileage for you.
That and every other reference you made, you know so much about movies. So I'm really glad we got a chance to do it.
I am too. And then just sort of lastly for people, just one quick thing, like what's your sort of joy space? Like what do you do outside? Is there anything outside of acting that sort of, you know, like just like a hobby, anything that makes you joyful, anything you do just for you? Is there anything outside of that?
Well, we're kind of doing it. Yeah, being back here. I have an orchard here, and so spending time with the trees right this time of year is really great. It's a very good, joyful time to be in California. It's pleasant weather. It's unbelievable. You know, temperatures in the 60s is the highest, and the birds are singing, and I've got an incredible amount of fruit this year because I got my gray water system going on this rows of 22 trees that I – now this year are given crazy amount of citrus. I got 4 different kinds of mandarins and limes and then some other exotic fruit trees. So that's giving me a lot of good, keeping me occupied too.
I hope you have a great rest of the day. Please stay safe and healthy. And hopefully we'll talk again sometime.
It's great. Great pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, Bill. Cheers. Take care.
Take care.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest. And they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.